Letters pop out from a white background, then turn red. Netflix. Against a dark gray background, light gray silhouettes of various people converge around red text forming a square above a gray world. Public Square Films. Grainy footage shows a group of people marching down the middle of the street under a purple balloon arch and a second made in rainbow colors. A man in a polka dot shirt at the front of the pack somberly carries a photo of a transgender woman. In a news report,
Marsha Johnson, a veteran of the Stonewall riots and a prominent figure among transvestites, was found dead in the river near Christopher Street Monday morning.
A video shows Marsha laughing. In the street, people continue to march with her photos. Public Square Films presents
Marsha, whose real name was Malcolm Michaels Jr., was last seen alive on Thursday.
A France and Thompson film. In the street, marchers hold signs, including one that reads, "Police, do your job."
The police list suicide as the cause of death, but community leaders cite a lack of evidence and charge that police have yet to begin an investigation into the death of this beloved founder of the gay movement. A demonstration is planned for next week on Christopher Street. Marsha was 46 years old and is survived by four brothers and two sisters. She will be greatly missed.
In a sparkly headband, Marsha wears a joyous grin. The flood of marchers moves down the street accompanied by police officers. In association with 90,000 Words, Faliero House Productions, Terrace M Media and Films, and Race Point Films, the title appears above the Manhattan skyline, The Death and Life of Marsha P. Johnson. On a wet sidewalk, a woman holding an umbrella walks with a cane. She wears a headscarf over her shell headband. Inside a building, letters on a wall read, New York City Anti-Violence Project. In a conference room, a bespectacled woman addresses several people sitting around a table, including the woman wearing the shell headband.
Do we have just about everyone? Okay, so let's start with the most recent incident, which is the one that happened over the weekend. A 35-year-old transgender woman was attacked outside of her home in Jackson Heights, Queens.
Last we heard was that the survivor is not yet conscious or able to communicate, and they've not been in a position where we could offer any support to them.
She had her head smashed against the curb of the sidewalk by someone who has fled and has not yet been apprehended.
Keep us posted.
And let us know what you need.
Remember, Anetel's case is back in court this Friday.
Yeah, we'll be there.
The older woman in the shell headband works in an office at a desk decorated with both the rainbow flag and the American flag. She wears a pin with Marsha's picture on it. Text appears. Victoria Cruz, crime victim advocate.
I've been working for the LGBTQ Anti-Violence Project for many years, and I'm about to retire. But there's a massive number of trans women who have been murdered, and their cases have just gone cold.
She jots a date on an index card.
And they're yelling out from their graves for justice. Most of them were unknown, but even famous people, cases go cold, just like Marsha. Marsha was famous all around the world. Her case has been cold for 25 years.
She writes more cards and posts them on a bulletin board.
If we can't bring justice for Marsha, how can we bring justice for all these other unsolved cases?
One reads July 6, 1992, found at 5:23 p.m.
I want to try to give Marsha justice before I leave.
A view moves down from the street signs at the corner of West Street and Christopher Street to a collection of bottles arranged near a barricade bordering a river.
This is the memorial that the street people laid down where they laid Marsha's body when they pulled Marsha out of the water. Right over the edge here.
Victoria rides the subway wearing a ring with the Ankh symbol. Now she and a tall man go through a storage unit stacked with file boxes.
You're looking for 92, right?
Yeah, it was July of 92.
Everyone knew Marsha. Marsha was so full of life, right? It's hard for me to believe that she would commit suicide.
A man kneels over the bottles. In the storage unit, Victoria sorts through a box.
Yeah, this is her case.
Later, Victoria tows the box behind her on a hand truck. She goes into a building and presses the elevator button with the tip of her cane. Footage shows a platinum blonde man crouching beside Marsha's bottle memorial.
I was there when they pulled her out.
Yeah? Where did you see her floating? Where did you see her floating?
Right over there. She was like about this right there, let's say. And the head was up and the feet were down. She wasn't floating flat. She was floating down.
Uh-huh.
And she had a hole in her head.
Marsha's death certificate lists the cause as drowning and how injury occurred as suicide.
How do you know she had a hole in her head?
I could see it.
Really?
You can't judge that.
Yeah. Oh, I know. Yeah, it could be the fish.
I'm just saying
it
was a hole. I'm not saying what happened. All I'm telling you is what I saw. She didn't look anything like me normal.
Victoria watches the video of the man in her office. At night, a blonde struts through a crosswalk. Three friends gather on a stoop. A view looks up at the West Street and Christopher Street signs. Static flickers and fuzzy black and white footage of the same corner replaces the image. A few men look out over the river. Text reads, "The Christopher Street Piers, Greenwich Village, New York."
Isn't this calming and nice to come here?
It's great.
They set aside this whole pier for us so we could come and relax here.
Wearing a long fur coat, Marsha walks toward them with a bright smile. One of the guys puts his arm around her.
Marsha Johnson, queen of the village, one of the great people. This is one of the most courageous people in the world. I've always loved people. I always wanted to put on drag, and I never had the courage. This is one of the people that has the courage, and bravo for him, her, or whatever he wants to be. And not only that, he doesn't give a shit whether he wears men's clothes or women's clothes, you know? Right? He's totally free.
Right.
If he feels
that's
like
right.
going out as a man, he goes out as a man. It feels like a woman.
How do you
woman.
Know all this?
If he feels like wearing
you
roller skates, he wears roller skates, whatever. I know Marsha Johnson. Marsha Johnson is our queen.
He hugs her.
Forever.
In the present, Victoria lifts up her glasses as she dials a phone.
You have reached the office of Chief Medical Examiner for the City of New York.
My name is Victoria Cruz, and I'm inquiring about Malcolm Michaels, who was found dead in 1992. There was an autopsy. How would I be able to get these particular information?
Are you calling from the media or?
I'm calling from the Anti-Violence Project here in New York City.
I can give you the cause of death and the manner of death. You would not be entitled to a full autopsy report. If you're looking for all that paperwork, then the family needs to request it in a written letter, and you can get the record that way.
Another day, cars sit parked on a suburban street, dirty piles of snow pushed off the road. Victoria approaches a home. Text reads, Elizabeth, New Jersey.
907.
She goes up some steps to a door and reads the label on a mailbox.
Michael's family.
Romance. How are you?
Pleased to meet you.
Pleased to meet you, too.
Yeah, I'll take this one, because it's much easier to get up from.
Okay. Okay, good.
Okay.
What do you know about the case?
I
really don't know anything.
Don't know
all
anything.
We know is that, you know, they found him in the river. That's all we know. We really don't
Jean
know
Michaels,
anything about
Marsha's
that.
Sister.
See, that's what we're investigating, because we have eyewitnesses that report seeing him, her.
Uh-huh.
What do you prefer for me to call?
That doesn't matter.
Marsha, okay.
Okay.
When was the last time you saw her alive?
We saw her before the 4th of July.
Monday, Tuesday.
I don't know what day that was.
It was during the week. She stopped by our house and I took him to the train station. He got on the train and that was it.
Robert Michaels,
then
Marsha's brother.
We got a phone call saying that he was dead.
Yeah, we sure did.
We went
to New York and everything.
Went up to New York.
And did you request to see the body?
Oh, no.
Oh, my sister asked. They told her no. They couldn't. They're not allowed to do that.
Okay. This is the letter that we requested in order to get the autopsy report, the toxicology report, and the pictures if some were taken.
And hopefully we can bring some closure to her case. Because to me, she was the Rosa Parks of the LGBT movement.
You miss her?
Yes, I miss him.
Mm-hmm. You adopted the name of Marsha, pay it no mind.
Yeah. Pay no mind. That's your problem, not mine.
Anything you did, he'd have you laughing. When he used to tell us stories, we didn't believe him. I tell him, oh, you're lying. You didn't know Andy Warhol. You didn't know those
people. Yes, she did. She knew a lot of famous people. She was famous herself.
In a photo, Marsha poses for Andy Warhol.
I didn't believe her. I thought he was joking. They and then did. Marsha couldn't do the sing. Horrible.
Oh, no.
Horrible.
No.
He could not sing.
Hey, now, ladies and gentlemen. Miss Marsha B. Johnson.
Old videos show Marsha singing to a crowd. In one, she wears a gold dress and shimmering eye makeup.
It's a delta to the night house. It's a god into a drink. It's a Theta, Cleopatra, and Cordelia to think. Now let's not be pessimistic. I say love is worth a try. Make no mistake, and let it fade. The price you pay is high.
The crowd claps their hands over their heads for Marsha in a headband made of mirrored tiles. In the present, Victoria goes down an escalator, then rides the subway. Now she glances around as she walks down a street. A view looks up at a high-rise building, Hoboken, New Jersey. Inside, a white-haired man in a tie-dyed, button-up shirt opens the door for Victoria.
Hi, Mandy. Hi. Remember me?
Yes, you look very familiar.
Yes, how are you?
Fine.
I like
yourself?
Your shirt. Oh, you got the same button, huh?
Yeah,
how
yeah,
are
yeah.
you?
Randy Wicker, Marsha's roommate.
So come on in the living room.
Okay.
As you see, Marsha's a big part of my life.
Yes, I know.
In my opinion, I want that picture someday to be in the Schoenberg Museum.
Okay.
They call her Andy Warhol model, prostitute, starring actress, and saint.
Where'd you meet Marsha?
I had a kid who lived with me who was sort of like an adopted son,
uh-huh.
Willie. That's a picture of Willie and Marsha right there. And one night it was like 5 degrees outside. He said, could Marsha come and sleep on the living room floor?
Mm-hmm.
So Marsha came in that night and stayed for the next 12 years.
What do you think happened to her?
Well, it certainly was not suicide. That was an insult to the family. No way could Marsha in any way have committed suicide.
Mm-hmm.
But, I mean, let's face it. I mean, the police department, they mm-hmm. had just made up their mind. This case is over with. We don't want to be bothered. Because this is a nobody. This isn't a person.
Let me ask you a question. Would you be able to give us any contacts or information that you may have?
Randy sorts through a cabinet, then struggles to get through the room jam-packed with belongings.
I have work to make this place more accessible.
He rifles through a partially opened drawer, blocked by a handled organizer.
Somewhere I have a printout of the names and contacts that I consider to be the best leads. Ah!
He pulls out some papers. Now he searches through drawers of cassette tapes.
Oh, okay, yep, I found that.
He plays a video from a camcorder cassette.
We began down at the river.
Who's we?
A group of Marsha's friends, maybe 20 people.
Uh-huh.
And this was the...
That was the memorial at the pier.
That was where her body laid in, mm-hmm. and damaged the sidewalk.
Randy emotionally watches the footage of himself speaking.
What we're really here today to talk about is what we're going to do about this loss of a national treasure, this icon of the gay community, this fighter of Stonewall. The cops aren't doing their job. They're just sitting on their fat ass over there, fixing a message to these people. We need mad justice here.
July 11th, 1992, 5 days after Marsha's body was found.
Join us. The precinct is not doing their job again.
We want some answers.
Well, I knew Marsha. Marsha was the happiest person I knew.
Protesters with signs approach a group of cops.
We know this wasn't a suicide. You guys closed your books on it and decided because she's a marginal citizen that you weren't going to do anything about it. Okay, we don't agree with that, and we want you guys to do your fucking jobs.
My name is Randy Wicker. I was the deceased roommate. I think the problem is at first it's been classified as a suicide, and I came to believe that there was a good chance of foul play because she was talking about the mafia after her and in a very bad state. We may never know what happened, but I mean, we want to see this investigation proceed in an orderly and thorough manner, and that the investigation will continue to accumulate evidence if new evidence does come available.
I don't think that it's possible for you to schedule
the meeting that will resolve this problem to your satisfaction today. I don't think that's possible.
We want justice here to find out who the hell murdered Marsha. Why you fucking people are standing here not doing your fucking job. Justice for Marsha.
Justice for Marsha.
Static flickers as the video ends.
Mm-hmm.
A glamorous-looking transgender woman smokes as the view focuses on her eyes, lined with dark makeup. July 22, 1994, 2 years after Marsha's death.
My name is Sylvia Rivera, and I'm given permission to have this filmed. When I met Marsha, must have been like 12 years old. She was like a mother to me. Marsha was an icon of the gay movement. Marsha was known through the world. Marsha and I, we were the liberators. The street people and the drag queens were the vanguard of the movement. We're the ones that stood the forefronts and fought the cops off, and we're the ones that didn't mind getting our heads bashed in. When I first came to this town ball, I was the only drag queen there just about. Uh-huh.
Marsha sits in a car.
I said, honey, why do you think I'm a boy or a girl? They didn't ask, I just go in. Because it was an old men's bar.
A time-lapse view shows a shadow creeping up an apartment building. Clouds roll in overhead, and darkness overtakes the city.
Stonewall was a very nice, campy little bar owned by the mafia, you know. Gay people were not allowed in bars. The mafia would pay off the cops. Typical of that era.
It was hard being a drag queen back then because they would take us into jail for no reason at all. We lived in an era that was unreal.
Archival footage shows the inside of the brick Stonewall Inn. People sit close and socialize in the dim space as bartenders serve the predominantly male clientele. On a dark dance floor, people move to the music.
I was spaced out on Black Beauties and Scotch. We were dancing, my lover and I.
June 28th, 1969.
Next thing we know, the lights came on and, hey, we're being raided.
Police file into the crowded bar.
Queens started being filed out and being, you know, put into police cars, and guns had been drawn. Molotov cocktails were flying, and I'm like, oh my God, the revolution is here, thank God. You've been treating us like shit all these years? Now it's our turn.
Footage shows fires in the street and police in riot gear. Voice of Marsha P. Johnson.
When I got downtown, the place was already on fire. Dominic Barron opened in the park having a cocktail. And we were in the street turning over cars and, oh my God, blocking traffic and screaming and hollering and everything. I mean, there was a lot of bloodshed that night. And the movement started the next day.
Everybody!
During the day, protesters march down the street. One sign reads, Gay Pride.
The world is having to notice what it used to try to ignore. Homosexuals no longer meekly meld away under the blast of scorn, ridicule, or hatred. Today's gay power people are struggling for full economic and legal recognition and acceptance.
A reporter interviews Marsha, a flower behind her ear. Carla J.
Marsha was very good-natured. She was funny. She laughed. But that shouldn't be mistaken for a lack of serious purpose and political intent.
Her mission in life is going about spreading peace and goodwill.
Augusto Machado.
To, you don't have to be dressed up in a suit. You can express yourself. She became, to me, like a bodhisattva, a holy person who would wander the village in whatever adornment she wanted, being at peace.
How will this affect you, your job? Hey. Darling, I don't have a job. I'm on welfare. I have no intentions of getting a job. It's only this country discriminates against homosexuals.
A view finds Sylvia Rivera in the crowd of protesters, her dark roots showing in her blonde hair.
Sylvia was always very outspoken. She was unrelenting. She was, Sylvia was very in your face, very intense eyes, a slash of a mouth, a guttural laugh like Marlene Dietrich. Sylvia was quite the serious one.
She pushed her way to the front line. Homes for the homeless, food for the poor, gay rights, gay rights.
Sylvia leads the crowd in a chant. Carla, an LGBT movement co-founder, continues.
After a while, I think they knew that they most had to concentrate on the area that no one was addressing for them, and that only they could address, and that was being transgendered.
Voice of Sylvia Rivera.
Marsha and I thought one day we needed to do something for our own. That's where Star was born. Street transvestite that action revolutionaries.
Voice of Marsha P. Johnson.
Sylvia Lee Rivera deserves all the credit for Star. I was just one of the queens that was behind her, like the vice president of Star. She knew exactly what she was talking about. She was talking about nobody's representing transvestites, you know?
Mark Siegel, LGBT movement co-founder.
The one thing that they had in common, which bonded them, and why their names should always be connected, is that they helped those who were in the street just trying to live their lives. And a lot of them got on that street and ended up hooking or hustling to make a buck. And they sometimes had no place to stay.
Voice of Sylvia Rivera.
Marsha and I started Star House to keep the kids off the streets.
Victoria holds a photo of Star House, 1970 to 1973.
Get these kids, get their things together.
Negatives show the young residents.
Star was part of the People's Revolution. And it was time for us to show the world that we are human beings.
I didn't know Marsha, but I became very close friends with Sylvia.
At an anti-violence project meeting.
Back in the late 60s, I was going out with Frankie, who was a bouncer at the Stonewall. Frankie was always cheating on me, and he was going out with Sylvia's best friend at the time. Sylvia and I didn't get along too well, so I had lost sight of her for 25 years. One day, I went to a meeting, and who was there? Sylvia. She sat right across from me, and she got up, and she says, I know you. And I got up, too, and I says, I know you, too. And then this button...
She points to her Marsha button.
She had it on her left side, popped out, and it just rolled to my feet. So one of the girls picked it up, and Sylvia says, no, give it to her, she's one of us. And from that moment on, we became very close friends. We spoke to each other at least twice a week. And she was always there for me and the community. And I will never forget that. When she spoke about Marsha, there was always a tear in her eyes. She loved Marsha. And she said that that was our mother.
What's been going on with the Marsha P. Johnson case?
There seemed to be conflicting evidence on the last time she was seen. Randy said he last saw her on the 2nd.
In a blurry video, Marsha mills in a crowd.
And then someone reported seeing her on the night of the 4th. And the body was found on the 6th.
Fireworks explode in the sky.
So we're going to ask more questions of people who knew her or reported seeing her during that time. And that's what we're trying to find out. We'll get to the bottom of it.
Okay.
In her office, Victoria references a typed sheet of paper and dials the phone. She scribbles something on the paper, then goes to the next page and punches in another number.
Please leave a message after the tone. When
she gestures exasperatedly, hangs up, and dials again.
Can I help you?
Yes, may I speak to Daniel Massanova?
That's me. What's the matter? What's up?
Daniel, my name is Victoria Cruz. I work for the Anti-Violence Project. I'm working on a reopened case from 1992.
What was the name of the victim?
Marsha P. Johnson.
Are you talking about the girl off the water?
Yes.
Yeah, that was Jimmy Abreu's case. Jimmy is retired like I am from the NYPD.
Okay, you wouldn't happen to have his number, would you?
No, I don't.
Now Victoria types the detective's name into a search engine.
I'm trying to get in contact with James Abreu.
I'm not familiar with that.
I don't know that person. There is nobody here named James Abreu.
Victoria scrolls to a photo in an online article. A close view shows a balding, tight-lipped man in court.
Carol.
I'm looking for James Abreu.
Yeah, hold on.
Jimmy. Phone call.
Hello.
James Abreu?
Yes.
Hi, my name is Victoria Cruz. I'm working for the Anti-Violence Project. I'm working on a reopened case on the Marsha P. Johnson case. That was, she was found in 1992 by Christopher Street Pier.
Right.
Can I meet with you in reference to this particular case?
Definitely not.
Because?
Because I'm retired from the NYPD and you're calling me at work.
Can we meet outside of your job?
No, definitely not. I don't want to meet in regards to anything.
He didn't want to tell me anything about the case. He doesn't want to look back.
I can't control what people say to you.
I understand.
I don't know if you, who you represent. I don't even know if, you know, if you are who you say you are. Are you a lawyer?
No, I'm not.
You a private investigator?
No.
I got to give you a little advice. Don't play detective yourself, all right? Leave this to the people that should handle it.
Victoria leans back in her chair. A sign behind her reads, "Love is not a crime." A view looks up at a tall stone building, a row of fluorescent lights glowing inside. In her apartment, a sleeping Victoria stirs, hugging a pillow. She sits up on the edge of her bed, wearing a shirt that reads, "Gender Nonconforming Person," in bold letters. In a photo, a slender brunette with a voluminous updo clutches her chest.
This is me in 67.
Another picture shows her with an exaggerated bouffant.
Look at the handos.
A third snap shows her on stage in a slinky black dress.
I was doing shows at the time. I just love the stage.
She applies eyeliner. In a photo, young Victoria grins on a catwalk before smiling spectators. She wears a white dress and flowers in her hair.
I used to do the catwalk in the city till they found out I was trans, and then I got booted out. Back in the 60s, it was against the law to be dressed in drag. I was very fortunate that I was small and petite, so I really wasn't detectable. I was very careful not to get arrested.
She dons her shell headband. Going through a photo album, Victoria flips to a topless shot of her younger self.
X-rated. This is my beach outfit when I had the body. I had a 24-inch waist.
In more pictures, she wears a platinum blonde wig.
I've been very blessed and lucky that my family accepted me. As a matter of fact, my mother was a dressmaker, and she was very supportive.
Victoria points out a man in an instant photo.
This was a friend of mine who got murdered back in 73. This is him in drag, Carlos Santos. We never found out who did it or cold case.
Later, Victoria leaves her apartment.
They just didn't care. They were trans. Outcasts. Society doesn't want them. I've dealt with those feelings. My own personal experiences.
On a train, feathers from Victoria's headband stick out from her braided salt and pepper hair as green countryside streaks past out the window. She ambles across a walkway leading to a building labeled Visitor Hospitality Center. Text appears as guards escort Victoria down a staircase. Downstate Correctional Facility, Fishkill, New York. A view looks out a window, the sun blazing through barbed wire. As Victoria waits at a table in an otherwise vacant visitation room, a guard brings in a tall, blonde, transgender woman, Kitty Rotolo, Marsha's friend.
Victoria?
It's Kitty.
Hi.
How are you?
Thank you so much for coming.
Thank you for allowing me to come.
Oh, darling, I'm Jay.
Thank you.
Sit, please.
Thank you so much.
You're more than welcome. Thank you. So I heard so much about you.
And was it good or bad?
It's all interesting.
Yes.
How did you meet Marsha?
I was probably 13 or 14 at the time. I would always pass Sheridan Square Park. And when I first saw Marsha, she was just this elaborate with feathers and plumes and makeup that was never put on correctly. And Marsha was all, oh, honey, you are fabulous. And you would make a beautiful girl. And she used to come by and snatch my hair up on both sides. And it made me feel so special. It made me feel like I wanted to be a part of that crowd. And Marsha and I remained great friends up until the day she died.
Have you seen this? This was a flyer that was given out.
I remember this poster being posted in the window of Uplift, which was Randy Wicker's store. And Randy had like this little memorial going on right there in the window. Yes, I do remember this.
Grainy footage shows a storefront display filled by a memorial for Marsha. On the sidewalk in front of the shop, two candles burn amidst a few flowers.
I had went in there once or twice after Marsha's death, just to pay my respects to him and offer my condolences to him. I actually never read this.
Kitty studies the flyer.
And, oh, anvil icon. Amazing, because the night that she was murdered, her and I were supposed to go to the anvil together.
Okay, tell me about that time.
I want to say it was the 4th of July.
Photos show them together.
I ran into Marsha in front of the Christopher Street bookstore. It was broad daylight. She was in full drag.
How intoxicated was she?
Marsha was always in her right mind. She always knew what the main prize was, you know. We separated. We were going to meet at midnight, and we were going to troll the streets back and forth, and we were going to go to the anvil. Like the usual time was 2 or 3 a.m. But she never showed up. And then later, I remember I was down by the Stroll.
In a dark video, people stride down a sidewalk. The Stroll, Greenwich Village, New York.
The girl Stroll, the queen Stroll, was on that left side. On the right side was where all the boys used to do their thing, the butch queens.
In a low-quality video, people loiter on the sidewalk as cars drive past.
I remember the girls had put me on point. Miss Kitty, watch out. There's a car full of Guidos, you know, driving around. And later that evening, I heard that Marsha had gotten in the car with them.
A woman climbs into a car.
On the stage, she was like, child, we told her not to get in that car.
The car pulls away. Victoria jots in a notebook.
And I never saw her again after that. From the 6th precinct, they just brushed it off like another one, you know, like another one bites the dust type of thing, you know. You know, it kind of makes me think, Victoria, what happens when a flower gets wilted?
They hold hands.
Does it just die away and it's forgotten?
Well, hopefully that flower would have shed some seeds that would grow a new movement.
Right.
That's what I hope.
At night, Victoria walks past the Stonewall Inn, pedestrians crossing in front of its quiet entrance.
Police are investigating a possible hate crime that led to the death of a transgender woman. 21-year-old Islyn Nettles was attacked on the street.
Nettles was out with another transgender female, a friend.
Police say the pair met a group of men who attacked them once they realized Nettles and her friend weren't born as females.
The friend tells investigator when she ran away to get help, the suspect was on top of Nettles, punching her in the face.
Nettles was punched in the head, hit the ground. She lapsed into a coma and later died. 20-year-old James Dixon faced a judge here at Manhattan Criminal Court. He's charged with manslaughter and assault.
This person beat my baby with their bare hands to death. And I don't feel he should walk in the streets because my baby can't walk.
Outside the criminal courts building, Victoria stands with a man in a green jacket, Ted McGuire, community advocate.
He faces anything between 5 and 25 years. The child was murdered in August of 2013. And this has been going on, we're going on 3 years already. So the family's been in limbo. This is a very important case. This place should be packed. Mm-hmm. There should be people standing outside that couldn't even get in the door. We had the gay marriage. Everyone was out for gay marriage. We used to march these streets up and down. We got arrested over here. We handcuffed ourselves to the thing. The privileged people, they got their gay marriage and now they're off. They're gone. And they left the transgender community behind. What about the rest of the community? What is the T? Remember the T? LGBT, you know?
In grainy footage, a march fills a city street. Marsha sits for an interview.
As long as my people don't have their rights all across America, there's no reason for celebration. That's how come I've been walking for gay rights all these years.
1973 Gay Pride March.
1973, they told Miss Sylvia Rivera that we get to lead the Gay Pride March with transvestites in the front of the parade. Honey, they took and pushed all the drag queens way in the back someplace. Honey, that was not the right thing to do. And they didn't care if you were there to get in the gay movement, demonstrated in drag and stuff. They don't care.
A huge crowd gathers around a stage in Washington Square Park. Carla Jay, LGBT movement co-founder.
Transgender people felt that they were being pushed to the side, that their place at Stonewall, that their place from the beginning was being forgotten.
I had been promised a spot to speak.
Voice of Sylvia Rivera.
And they were having a conflict about drag queens on stage because we were supposed to be stereotyped. But if it wasn't for a drag queen, there would be no gay liberation movement for the frontliners. I said, well, I'm going to speak one way or the other.
Sylvia walks on stage.
One person, a man, Sylvia, gets up here and...
Just a moment. Just a moment. I would like to avoid any trouble. This is a day of unity for us. I want us to be happy. Sylvia!
Sylvia snatches the mic. The top layer of her unruly hair dyed blonde. She grins. She bites her lip with confident derisiveness and gestures at the jeering crowd. Sylvia picks up the mic stand defensively as a woman marches over to her. Sylvia points off stage and the woman moves the stand away.
Y'all better quiet down. I've been trying to get up here all day for your gay brothers and your gay sisters in jail. They're right mean every motherfucking week. And ask for your help. And you all don't do a goddamn thing for them. And they write star, not the women's group. They do not write women. They do not write men. They write star because we're trying to do something for them. But you all tell me to go and hide my tail between my legs. I will not put up with this shit. I have been beaten. I have had my nose broken. I have been thrown in jail. I have lost my job. I have lost my apartment for gay liberation. And you all treat me this way? What the fuck's wrong with you all? Think about that. I believe in the gay power. I believe in us getting our rights, or else I would not be out there fighting for our rights. That's all I wanted to say to your people. Come and see the people at Star House on 12th Street. The people that are trying to do something for all of us and not men and women that belong to a white middle class club. And that's what you all belong to. Revolution now!
She raises her fist in the air. Her face clenches with anguish. The view sweeps over the sea of spectators filling the park. In her interview, Sylvia wears a distant look.
I was hurt, and I felt that the movement had completely betrayed the drag queens and the street people. And I felt that, you know, the years that I had already given them had been a waste. So I went home, locked up the house. If it wasn't for Marsha, I wouldn't be here right now. I got 60 stitches in this arm. She came home and found me bleeding to death.
Photos from the day of the march show Sylvia with a fiery expression, then an emotional one.
After the march in 1973, I left the movement.
A street-sweeping vehicle drives down a clean road lined with cars and businesses. A bicyclist rides along with the light traffic.
I found myself up in Westchester.
Sylvia stands on a stage in a gold gown.
Good evening, ladies and gentlemen. Welcome to the Music Hall in Terrytown. I want to give special thanks to everyone in the audience that's been supporting us.
As she dances, Sylvia lifts her dress on each side of a waist-high slit, exposing her underwear.
Of course, you get the first strange looks. Hey, Bobby. I say, you become friends with everybody.
Several drag queens join her on stage.
I feel that I have liberated a lot of people just by living here in the suburbs, just by being this. Just by being a campy queen. And they appreciate, they really do.
Another night, a drag queen with a purple feather boa dances with Sylvia.
That's how I was letting out most of my anger. But I will not forgive the movement for anything that they have done to my community.
The curtain closes. Riding a bus, Victoria stares ahead. After disembarking at a gas station, she waves to the driver. Now she walks along a shoulderless road, wearing a thick coat with a fur-lined hood. She arrives at a house with snow in the yard. Pine Hill, New York. Inside, she embraces a transgender woman wearing glasses.
Come on, oh, come on, girl. Sorry. Yes, girl.
Oh, good to see you.
Nice hug.
Yeah,
Rusty May Moore, community advocate.
Good hug.
So can I open this?
Sure. Thank you. You can light it up if you like, too.
Light it up?
Incense. Chelsea, come here, girl. What's the matter with you? Give me a hug, baby. Blessed be.
Blessed be. How you doing?
Victoria hugs the long-haired trans woman.
Anything you may be able to tell me may be very, very helpful.
I don't know anything that you can't get better from Randy Wicker.
Chelsea Goodwin, community advocate.
But maybe you can tell me about the cops that were around during that time.
I really can't.
You can't?
No.
All right. you went on an investigation in a white van with Randy. Remember that?
In a video, Chelsea smokes in the passenger seat of a van.
Do you always smoke this much, or is this just because you're a little nervous?
I always smoke this much when I'm down here, baby.
The stroll, 2 weeks after Marsha's death.
Funny, it's a fishing expedition. We'll either catch something or we won't. We're just kind of trolling.
In the present, Chelsea keeps her gaze lowered.
Let's start all over. Randy wanted to talk about about Marsha and how Marsha died and how he suspected that she was murdered and... Could I make some highly irregular and very unofficial inquiries? And I did, and I really didn't come up with anything. I wish I had.
In the video from the van.
I want to park the van. You're going to go talk to the girls. You're going to be out that back window with the camera.
Close the door so the lights go off.
You know, I asked around a... peers and in the neighborhood and asked around because I knew a lot of the girls that were just walking around looking into matters on my own or whatever.
In the dimly lit video, Randy and Chelsea continue driving at night.
How long have you been involved in this?
12 years. I was out on the street with no place to go and no money. Most of these girls are underage. Most of them are more throwaways than runaways. And the older ones are people like me that started out when we were young. And
you're a survivor, then.
Yes. practically the only one still alive from the girls I first started with.
What happened to most of them?
Drug overdoses, suicides, murdered by Johns, murdered by pimps. A lot of girls just plain fucking disappear the way Marcia did.
In the present.
Marcia can't even be understood in 1992 without the context of dead trannies were literally washing up on the street. I mean, lying there dead and no interest shown whatsoever in doing a damn thing about it. You know more about this than I do.
Victoria nods. Later, a train trundles along an above-ground track. Below, Victoria strolls down a city street, slowing to gaze at a stone building. Letters above the entrance read, Cobble Hill Health Center.
Before the Anti-Violence Project, this is where I worked from 1993 to 1996. Until I was sexually assaulted and physically assaulted by nurses and aides in this building. Right after this happened, I couldn't feel the ground beneath me. And I would get up in the morning and just walk, walk, and walk, and walk. It was like I was walking in a daze, but when I stopped right there on Congress Street, I had a knife in my pocket because I wanted to hurt them. What stopped me was that I was thinking about my mother and how would she feel if I went to jail? It took me 3 days to get enough guts because I was angry. And I finally made the call to AVP. And the person was so understanding and knew what I was going through. I spoke with her for over 2 hours of what I was feeling.
Newspaper article headlines read, Attack on transgendered worker invokes protests. And, once a victim, now she helps, next to a photo of Victoria.
The agency stood with me for a year that I kept on going into court, back and forth, case canceled, case postponed, and I felt supported, so I just wanted to give back. So I volunteered for the Anti-Violence Project. Fortunately for me, a space opened up at the administrative assistant, and from there I moved myself up to domestic violence counselor advocate. Helped myself, my family, and the community.
In her office, she sits with Eddie DeGrand, intern at AVP.
Was AVP involved with the investigation then?
Of Marcia's case? Yes.
Okay.
We've been around since 1980.
Yeah.
So during that time, you know, we were involved in the case. And here's some of the flyers that AVP had given out. That's Marcia. There's a death certificate. We haven't got the toxicology report or any pictures or anything like that. That's what we're trying to get to see what condition the body was in, and if it says that she had a hole in the head.
It sounds like a lot of people think it was a murder or that she was pushed.
A lot of people think that it was foul play, but they first said it was suicide. Okay. Some people say she was giving things away and flowers and some of her clothing. Yeah. I says, well, you know, sometimes a person, when they're gonna commit suicide, they give their things away.
Yeah.
But then at the same time, that's how she was all the time.
She was always giving.
She was always giving things away. Somebody says, "Oh, I like your scarf. Here, darling."
Yeah.
Just to give them the scarf, or she would go around giving flowers.
Yeah.
That's Marcia.
Footage shows Marcia wearing a sparkly headpiece at a parade.
She had too much to live for. Like she was looking forward to gay pride. She showed up with pride.
Mm-hmm.
And was her old regal self and joyful self and things like that. Just normal Marcia.
Yeah.
Marcia! Marcia! Marcia!
But the police, they didn't pay it any mind. Something that they were accustomed to sweeping under the rug. Things that still go on. Nothing really has changed.
At a protest, someone holds a sign that says, Islam Nettles was my sister, with a photo of the victim. In the courts building, Victoria sits with a woman.
So what's going on with this case, huh?
They're going to get motions. They're going to set for motions. Then they're going to jury selection on Monday.
Okay.
You know, he confessed already twice to the detective and to the witness.
How much time do you think he's going to get?
Who knows?
Back in the 70s, we went through all this crap. But back then, it's just that you didn't hear about all these killings, you know.
you didn't hear about it because now it's more media coverage.
Right, that's
Francis Ball, Victoria's friend.
I gotta text my honey. Sorry, I have some private business.
Oh, my God. Honey.
I'm in love with him. Really.
You're in love with him? You'll be sorry.
Why? Why do you say that?
Huh? Foolish little girl. Fickle little girl. He didn't want him when he wanted you.
Francis moves to a different bench and looks at her phone. In archival footage of a march, people walk down the street holding candles. Someone holds a sign that reads, "Fighting for Our Lives, an AIDS Candlelight March." A child in her mother's arms lifts a candle in the air as a choir sings. Marsha and a group of men watch emotionally. Coco Rodriguez, Marsha's friend.
She tried to help through the AIDS epidemic. Like, if you were sick, she'd sit right by you. She'd stop by and say, "Okay, are you okay? Do you need something?" She was helping a person survive.
White balloons float into the air in front of a church.
I always meet these young people that don't have nobody that wants to stick by them and help them, you know? So I help them out, you know? With like a place to stay or some food to eat or a little change for their pockets.
They're not paying me no mind, nothing.
And you can't find another butterfly like that in life. She always changed from her cocoon. And you never knew what she was going to wear.
Footage shows Marsha and Randy at home.
Did you see this morning's treatment? Didn't you love that?
What was this morning's treatment?
With the little hair doing everything.
Oh, yeah. Did you see the fur coat I got her?
Marsha slips it on.
There she is. It's America.
Well, tomorrow morning I'll give you the breakfast sheet when I'm fixing breakfast for you.
Yes.
I'm gonna put on my Valentine outfit.
I love it.
And you're going to be
gagging. Breakfast.
Yes, you're going to be gagging. You'd be surprised how many gorgeous clothes Randy got around here that, for me that I don't even wear.
All the red velvet suits?
Yes, and all the furs. Oh, we're going to give you the treatment tomorrow morning. Just get your heart ready for heart failure.
Two subway trains going in opposite directions pass each other on neighboring tracks. In one car, Victoria, wearing earbuds, pops a tape into a cassette player and presses a button.
Are you taping all this?
Yeah.
Right now?
Right.
He's gonna try and write an article to try and help.
I'm trying to get some information about what's going on West Street with the police harassing everybody.
In my whole time of having any dealings with the 6th Precinct Fire Squad, these little creeps slapped me. Threatened to kill me. Told me right in the precinct. In front of everybody. The woman's glasses. He says, "What are you, a girl or boy?" Next thing I knew, I was getting punched in my jaw.
First time, it was all around the corner. And somebody had just said, "Run." And he just started beating on me and kicking me in the chest.
Oh, I made you that to a lot of people that run.
He pulled out his gun. He said, "If you come back down here, I'm gonna shoot you." And the other cop said, "I ought to throw him in the water, but they said he might be too skinny, he might not hit the bottom."
Yeah.
It seems believed that it is their job and duty to extricate all transvestites, to torture transvestites.
In her office, Victoria writes "dirty cop" on an index card. Later, she video chats with Matt Foreman, former director of AVP.
How many trans murders did AVP record in 1992?
That summer, it was the worst summer ever. We had many, many marches. We were demonstrating all the time because that was a way to get public attention and police attention. The anti-LGBT violence was at a peak. I mean, that year we had 1,300 reports of bias crime.
And some of them were from the police?
Yeah, I mean, if you look at the annual reports there, you're going to see whatever 12-18% of those were based on violence perpetrated by police.
Was this after or before Marsha's demise?
At a protest, Marsha waves to the camera.
It was going on before what happened to Marsha, and it went on for a long time. It's that whole period. We were sick at heart about this unrelenting way of attacks.
Particularly given the circumstances surrounding Marsha's death.
At another protest, marchers hold Justice for Marsha signs. A triangular sign on a pole points at the street and reads, "Someone was bashed here." Bystanders and restaurant patrons observe the protest. One holds a flyer that says, "Straits, read this." The horde of protesters marches behind a banner reading, "Stop the violence, queers fight back."
What was the community's relationship with the Sixth Precinct?
It was not positive because there was not an adequate response from the police to all this violence. There wasn't an adequate response from One Police Plaza that went all the way down to the Sixth Precinct.
A shirtless man stands on a stoop and gives a double thumbs down, and some of the protesters point toward him. The man sits, two police officers in front of him.
They did not pay sufficient attention to crimes like what happened to Marsha. It was obvious that she'd been murdered, and it was obvious that the police weren't giving it the attention that it deserved.
The view moves over the diverse group of Justice for Marsha protesters. In her office, Victoria takes four VHS tapes out of a plastic bag. On her computer, she presses play on a video interview of Marsha. June 14th, 1992, 3 weeks before Marsha's death.
I mean, I don't have any peace at home anymore, doll. My roommate Randy's out really after people from the festival committee.
Oh, Tommy, thank you, doll. I mean, he's doing this whole great big trip with all these organizations to change all these people around lately. Which can get you murdered, you know. Honey, I'm waiting until they get a hold of you for taking their money away. Randy tries to put me in the middle of it. I don't want it. I tell him, I don't bite my tongue for nobody. I tell him I don't want to be bothered. So, honey, we're wondering when the mob is going to come with the bullets.
I understand you.
And when the mob comes, darling, they say, "Why are you giving out these flyers? What do you got against us?" "Oh, I don't have anything against you. It's just that my roommate suspects that you have been racketeering and stuff."
Marsha laughs good-naturedly, and Victoria studies the video with a serious expression. Now she writes "mob" on an index card. On a bulletin board, a header reads "scenarios." Beneath it are more cards marked "suicide," "accident," "four Guidos," "dirty cop," and "mob." On a TV program, Randy holds up a flyer and addresses the camera.
"Hi, my name is Randy Wicker. I have started the campaign to expose and replace the Christmas Street Festival Committee."
At a street festival, a table is covered in flyers that say, "Expose, replace, take back the day."
"Tired of shady operators running the Christopher Street Festival and Gay Pride Day? Where do all those festival dollars go?"
He hands out the flyers.
"The Christopher Street Festival Committee is widely rumored to be mob controlled. We're going to take this festival back. We're going to run it for our community. Take back the day."
In a bar, Victoria sits opposite a short-haired woman.
"Remember this event here, Take Back the Day, where Randy was trying to take back the Christmas Street Festival from the mob?"
The woman, Candida Scott Peel, LGBT Pride Day organizer, looks at the flyer, then takes off her glasses.
I remember he had signs about it, and it was a concern with them. I don't remember a particular day.
"Who was running the Christmas Street Festival during that time that you remember?"
A clip shows young Candida.
"If you just take charge and make a logical decision, people will follow."
Heritage of Pride would organize the annual march, rally, and dance. We'd march downtown along Fifth Avenue into the village. And in the village, there was the annual Christopher Street Liberation Festival, it was called, which is basically booths and meat on a stick and, you know, your standard street festival. The guys who ran the festival were Ed Murphy, who had been a bouncer at the Stonewall, and then his friend Red Mahoney. And Red Mahoney was his, assistant. They worked for whatever part of the mafia ran the gay bars at the time. They did their thing and we did ours, and...
Okay, the reason I'm bringing this up because Marsha would go around saying that the mob was after her, things like that. That's the reason I'm asking.
No, I could see getting that upset. I could see getting that upset. But the gay bar business wasn't going to be where you put your folks who could shoot well, and it wasn't where you put folks who could run the business. It was what you did with the idiot nephew who wasn't capable of really being a mobster. He was capable of showing up and, you know, getting whatever percentage at the door he got and selling overpriced toilet paper.
Well, Randy Wicker hired Sam Saccone to do an investigation. And there was some guy named Jacques Garon.
You know, so a couple of the accusations that are being made about the festival committee itself is that it's backed by some of the mob. Two, that, you know, you're making a lot of money and a lot of profit off of this thing, and nothing ever goes back to the gay community with it.
The first thing is about the mob connection. That rumor has been going on for centuries. I've been involved in the committee for 7 years, and I've never seen any kind of mob connection whatsoever, because I wouldn't be involved if that would be the case. Number two, as far as making a lot of money, God, I wish. The only money that we get is through the sale of the boots on Christopher Street.
Jacques Garon, Festival Committee Director.
What happens with that money?
That money is given back in many ways. We have a lot of people that, you know, we help throughout the year. And we don't make a big issue out of it because we don't want to.
It's outrageous that these kind of people, Jacques Garon and Red Mahoney, are running our particular event. So I say that we're going to take this festival back. We're going to run it for our community. We have nothing to fear but fear itself. This is Randy Wicker saying, keep the faith.
Randy was good at antagonizing people, but why stop at knocking off Marsha? Why not punish Randy?
Now Victoria follows Eddie and the tall man to the storage unit. Eddie rolls up the door and the trio starts going through the file boxes. Eddie opens a binder inside a box.
Call logs. That's what you're looking for, right?
Yeah, call logs. To see if there's anything we miss.
Maybe it's one of those two boxes there. Wouldn't you know it?
What's this here?
Miss Vicky, do you need help?
Nah.
See, come. Yeah. Okay, Miss Vicky.
The man stands by Victoria as she scrutinizes papers in a box.
Here it is.
Found it?
Yeah.
At night, a view looks through a chain-link fence at the glittering Manhattan skyline.
Okay.
In her apartment, Victoria settles down at a table with a notebook and pen. She focuses on a handwritten section of a phone log form.
Received the call. Do you know Randy Wicker?
She flips to a blank page in her notebook and writes.
Tell Randy Wicker to leave Jacques Garon, Red Mahoney, and did not get name alone. Or what happened to Marsha Johnson will happen to him.
Shit.
The last phrase reads, he then hung up. On a rainy day, Victoria heads into AVP's building. In her office, she video chats with Matt Foreman.
It was a very chilling phone call, particularly given the circumstances surrounding Marsha's death and everything that was going on with the festival committee.
And then, I don't know if this happened the same day, you received a call from Roger McFarlane, and he said he remembers seeing Marsha on the 5th. At 4 a.m. in the morning on 22nd Street, he said that Marsha was kind of terrified and was being followed by two guys going west to the river. And was that reported to the police?
That was reported to the police.
Yeah, because that determines that someone saw Marsha on the 5th and her body was found on the 6th.
We made that statement publicly known. It was up to the police to follow up on it.
Right. Then that would tie in about Randy taking on the mob, the call that you got of Marsha being followed and her death.
Well, those pieces certainly fit together.
you know, there's all these pieces here that point to exactly what we were saying back then, mm-hmm. that Marsha did not die by suicide. In any other community, had a similar hero been found dead under unclear circumstances, it seems self-evident that the city would have put resources, real resources, behind it to try to figure out what happened.
Victoria watches a video of Marsha smiling at the camera. June 27th, 1992, 1 week before Marsha's death. In another video, Randy distributes flyers.
Cold Case Squad, Detective Litwin can help you.
Yes, good afternoon, Detective Litwin. It's Victoria Cruz.
Hi, how are you?
Very well, thank you. Yourself?
Very good, thank you. Okay, I know that you had spoken to a couple of retired detectives, and they called me because I investigated this case about 2 years ago. And I'm not going to say she committed suicide, but there's no credible evidence that she was murdered. None.
Well, let me ask you a question. Did the police ever record the threats that were made to Randy Wicker?
That's never come up at all. I don't have any record of that, so I can't really, mm-hmm. I can't really say anything on that, you know? Did AVP ever pass that on to the police department?
They said they did. And what about the sighting of Marsha on the 5th at 4 a.m. in the morning on 22nd Street? Mm-hmm. She was kind of frightened because there were two men following her and she was rushing down towards the Hudson River. Do you know if the police ever recorded two people following her, two males?
I see no record of that in the case.
You see no record of that?
No,
in the...
there was never anything conveyed to the police about her being seen on the 5th and being followed. So that's new to me.
Victoria squints toward her bulletin board, where a tacked-up flyer says, 6th Precinct, Are You Blind? And a printed article is titled, Death of a Drag Queen. Another headline reads, Christopher Street Festival Organizers Under Fire. Victoria gazes up at the board, and the view glides over a map of an area near the Hudson River. Handwritten notes mark the Christopher Street Pier and the location where Marsha's body was found and pulled from the river. Another day, Victoria sits inside the sparsely populated bar. With her notes and a pen in front of her, she turns back as Randy enters and joins her at the bar.
So how you been?
Pretty good.
Okay. Listen, I have a couple of questions to ask you because all that we've been finding out,
right,
points to the mob.
Okay.
What do you know about that?
So Marsha had a fear, apparently had a fear about the mob or the mafia. And because I was investigating the Christopher Street Festival Committee.
Have you and Marsha ever had a conversation about this particular subject, you taking on the Christopher Street Festival and the mob? Maybe that's why she didn't want to go back home. She thought like she was in danger.
She probably raised the issue with me about what I was doing. I don't remember that, but I remember if she had, I would have laughed at it, you know, because to me it was just a political fight. Mm-hmm. And I don't think in terms of political fights of being heavy duty where they come out and they murder your roommate because they don't like what you're doing. Harry Japria tried to get control of the festival a couple years before I did, and they were threatened.
By
the mob. They told me, Randy, don't do this. We tried to do it and we were threatened. And I said, well, I'm gonna do it.
Well, on July 28th, they made a threat to you.
She opens a folder and shows him the phone log form.
Here. At 5:55 on the 28th, just 5 minutes before AVP closes, Matt Foreman gets this call. Do you know Randy Wicker? And Matt said yes. And then he said, tell Randy to leave Jacques Garone, Red Mahoney, and another person, did not get named, alone, or what happened to Marsha Johnson will happen to him. And the person hung up.
Oh, God.
Randy's wide, shocked eyes shift from the page.
I am sure that he did not tell me that. I'm willing to bet you now.
So then you were never threatened when you took them on?
No, I never. I would. Who would forget that? When people would tell me things about the mob and whatever, I was the one that just don't go there. I was actually in. I look at it now. I realize I was really in heavy denial. That might have been why she ended up staying out, and why staying out, she went to, instead of being home and safe in Hoboken, you know, with me and. Mm-hmm. And the dog and all and our family.
Could I say you're blaming yourself for it?
Yeah, I think that's I mean, that really bothers me. I mean, I didn't know that.
Victoria nods at the tearful Randy. Footage from inside a church shows a stand displaying a black and white photo of Marcia strutting down the street. A diverse group of people fills the pews, with some attendees standing in the back. Sylvia speaks into a mic at the lectern.
This is a beautiful turnout. And she's gonna be so proud. And remember that the last name, the middle name was Marcia P. Johnson, and the peace name was Peggy Johnson.
Many people sit with their heads bowed, and others wipe away tears. A painting in front of the pulpit depicts a grinning Marcia. Sylvia sings in the pulpit with a few others, her shoulders heaving as she sobs. Grainy footage shows the group of people marching down the middle of the street under a purple balloon arch and a second made in rainbow colors. Randy, in a polka-dot shirt at the front of the pack, somberly carries a photo of Marcia. By the Christopher Street piers, people gather around the collection of bottles filled with flowers. Sylvia stands near the barricade bordering the river. Randy dumps ashes into the Hudson before tearfully addressing the crowd. Marcia's friends and admirers shelter under umbrellas as, above, the bright rainbow balloon arch floats off into the dull sky. A triangular marker on a post reads, Queer Space, Marcia P. Johnson, 1945 to 1992. Born Malcolm Michaels, Stonewall veteran, performer, panhandler, prostitute, Warhol model. Sylvia Rivera, now with a scruffy beard touched with gray, drinks a beer. She leans over an outdoor sink in a vacant lot populated by a few makeshift shelters. The Christopher Street Piers, Greenwich Village, New York, 1995, 3 years after Marcia's death.
How long have you lived here? I've been here since a week before Gay Pride Day this year. This is my little house.
Her home, made of salvaged junk, is tiny and cluttered.
When I got that telegram, the marshal was dead. Part of me went with her because one of our pacts was that we would always cross River Jordan together. And to me, this is the River Jordan, the Hudson River. And that's when I started reaching for the bottle more heavily than I was doing.
She faces the Hudson, the view obstructed by full garbage cans and piles of debris.
After Marsha's death, New York City.
In a parade, Sylvia, wearing a red mini dress, walks in front of the Stonewall car. Beneath two rainbow balloon arches, Sylvia spins and holds a can in a paper bag. She waves to the crowd as she marches beside a platinum blonde drag queen. Someone carries a Justice for Marcia poster. Sylvia raises her arms, flashing a peace symbol with one hand and holding a sign with the other. Back at the Christopher Street piers, Sylvia attaches a button with Marsha's picture on it to her shirt.
Can't forget Marsh.
She glances fondly down at her friend's picture, then sips from a plastic cup. In her office, Victoria holds her desk phone to her ear.
Breakfast, Miss Henry.
Hi, good afternoon, Miss Henry. My name is Victoria. I sent an inquiry in reference to getting the medical examiner's records from a case back in 92, and I was just wondering if you've received it.
Okay, Victoria, I'm getting ready to send you a letter to say that as of now, our office can't locate this case file.
You can't locate the case file?
Yeah, right.
Any particular reason it's not locatable?
I don't know. It's not in archives, and it's not in the container.
That's kind of strange.
These things do happen every now and again.
Did some other department check that out, or your department did?
It's my department only that has custody of those case files.
And then in all your 1992 cases, the only file that's missing is that one?
I wouldn't say that. I've never said that, and I will never say that.
You search, personally?
Yes, correct.
And who can I speak to more or less to get something really done on this case?
I don't know who to tell you.
Another day, a trans woman speaks in front of the court building. Jennifer Louise Lopez, community advocate.
We're here today to support justice for Islam Nettles. Today, we'll be to start to the trial at 9:30. We're hoping that the outcome of the trial, whenever trial ends, is going to be the maximum sentence for James Dixon, the person accused of killing Ilan Nettles. That maximum sentence is 25 years, and that's what we're asking the DA to ask the judge for.
An NYPD bus marked correction drives past. A woman wearing a scarf interviews Victoria.
You've been following Marsha's case. So what has, like, this case, like, has it helped to bring some light to past cases of violence against transgender people?
No, on the contrary, just as, like, most cases that come up against trans women, they plead the panic defense, or they just think they can brush it under the rug and people will pay no mind to it.
Can you actually speak a little bit more to this panic defense?
The panic defense, well, they didn't know she was a trans woman. There was a case back in 97, Fitzgerald case. Picked up this person in a gay bar, male gay bar, and took them home. In court, he didn't know she was a trans woman. The person was stabbed multiple times, and he got off. Pleaded panic defense. Just like now in the Nettles case, he claimed he panicked, that's his defense.
Later, Victoria enters the courtroom. Footage looks out over the Hudson River. A news report shows the makeshift shelters in the lot at the piers.
The West Side Highway is due for a fix-up. It's been a long time coming. There are concerns about uprooting some people there. The homeless will be asked to move tomorrow morning at 8 a.m. The plans call for the Hudson River Boulevard, trees, traffic for seven lanes, and paths for bikers, joggers, and skaters. The homeless will have to pack up their few possessions and get out.
Well, there's a sense of anger and desperation here for about 30 homeless people who call Pier 54 their home.
What about going to a shelter or getting some of the services that are available? Is that not an option for you?
The city shelter is an option.
You feel like it's safer where you are here?
Yes. It's called a sweep. Not even a fucking eviction. A sweep. Like we're trash.
Wearing sunglasses and a red bandana, Sylvia looks out over the lot, where a few NYPD officers patrol the area. Pacing, she turns around. The police officers walk toward the shoddily made shelters.
There's so many fucking buildings in this fucking Manhattan that they can't give up a fucking building to fucking maybe 15 people that would go in and try to re-renovate it. Marsha and I did it back in the 70s on our own. Yeah, crazy, because the world has made me crazy. Don't be going in my house. Excuse me, don't be going in my house.
She marches over to the officers and gestures emphatically at one. Now Sylvia starts tearing apart her shelter, ripping away panels and removing planks from the makeshift roof. She pulls on a tarp wrapped from the roof to the wall, but it doesn't budge. Later, she tosses items out of her home. She finds a stuffed animal. Now she sits outside the shelters with it in her lap. Sylvia gazes ahead with tears in her eyes. She blinks, her face clenched in a mournful expression.
Marsha, we tried.
She puts a weary hand to her face, then touches her bandana. A view looks up at Sylvia as she stands with the stuffed animal under her arm, white clouds hanging in the pale sky. She wanders down to the edge of the river and toward a rubble-strewn pier, chucking the stuffed animal into the water. Birds swoop over the water before the Manhattan skyline. At home, Victoria switches on a light and removes her jacket.
Hi, Miss Henry.
A package was mailed out to you.
Okay, so you mailed us the autopsy report.
I mailed you whatever I was able to put together, okay?
Uh-huh. So we're going to be receiving it in the near future?
Yes.
Okay. Thank you. You've been most helpful.
Eddie, holding a large envelope, knocks on Victoria's door.
Hi, Eddie.
Hi.
Come on in.
Did you bring the report?
Yeah.
Okay, Miss Henry said it was only partial.
Is it a big envelope?
Yeah. It's kind of heavy.
This looks flimsy.
Victoria opens the envelope.
Office of the Medical Examiner, City of New York, have performed an autopsy on the body of Malcolm Michaels on the 7th day of July, 1992 at 1:30 p.m. But they classified it as drowning first, but then they circled possible homicide. Like here.
It looks like they found a lot of discoloration, mm-hmm. but no evidence of trauma. Mm-hmm.
No,
does that
no trauma
right
on
you?
The skull, yeah. There is a sub... I don't know what the fuck this word is. Maybe we should look at another examiner's look at them.
Or get somebody.
Have a professional look at this autopsy.
Dr. Kildare.
Doctor, who's that?
Before your time.
Images of photos on CD.
Victoria holds a smaller envelope from the office of the medical examiner. Moments later, Eddie takes a CD out of a case and settles beside Victoria, facing a TV.
Okay.
Eddie's shoulders heave with a deep breath, and the first image starts to appear on screen.
Oh God.
Oh. Victoria wears a distressed expression. Elsewhere, Victoria sits with Dr. Michael Bodden, independent medical examiner. They are joined by Jean Michaels, Marsha's sister, and Al Michaels, Marsha's nephew.
What we have here is an unwitnessed drowning. She went into the water while still alive and breathing. It wasn't a situation where death occurred someplace else, mm-hmm. by whatever means, and then put in the water. Whether she's pushed in, whether she's being chased and falls accidentally, we can't tell from the autopsy. That depends on the police investigation.
Could you rule out a violent assault?
Yes, there's no evidence there of violent assault. There was no injury, no impact injury to any part of her body. There was no fracture of the skull. There was no damage to the brain at all.
What about the hole in the head?
Well, the body gets injured after death, okay. by floating debris and all that. And the body starts breaking apart faster in warmer water. So what looks like gash on the left side is really just a peeling of skin.
Okay.
But it's just normal separation of skin.
I don't think it was a suicide. It could have been an accident. He could have, and they said the pier was dilapidated. He could have stepped through a hole in the pier. Or people could have been following him. And because there was no evidence of any type of trauma to the body, that don't mean they beat him up and threw him in the water. They could have chased him, scared him, and he also fell through the pier. Yes.
That certainly brings up the issue of homicide, because if somebody is being chased and runs in front of a car or accidentally falls into the water, runs into the water, that would be called a homicide.
Well, we have documentation where she was frantic being followed. Credible person giving this report to our agency, and then wasn't even investigated.
Dr. Bodden examines a page of Victoria's notes.
Well, there's no statute of limitation on homicide, and that goes beyond my pay grade.
At night, a boat cuts across a swath of red light reflected on the dark water. In her office, Victoria sits opposite Beverly Tillery, director of AVP.
Something's wrong. We keep on running into a brick wall whenever we deal with the city. Every time I spoke to a cop and they just brushed me off, something's wrong. Every time I made a call, oh, you have to do this and this and this, something's wrong. Why this particular case? I think maybe we should go up one step higher and maybe seek some assistance from someplace outside of New York City to just look over what we have here. You know, it's obvious that the police are not cooperating with this.
Well, we don't have an endless pot of people or time or resources. And so I'm not really sure what is involved in that. You know, we just today, you know, you all were at the trial for Elon Nettles. I mean, there are so many cases and so many have not had any resolution. We've had in the last couple of months a number of murders across the country.
Eight transgender women across the country have been murdered in the last 34 days.
There have been more than 400 people murdered in the past decade.
Transgendered women face the most severe violence within the LGBTQ community.
A transgender woman was found strangled to death.
Police say she was stabbed several times.
In street lingo, it was a curb stomp. He was dressed as a woman.
And shame on the media for calling us men dressed in women's clothing. Shame on the media for that.
This cannot go unanswered. I say hands off my sister.
Do we not deal with the immediate needs there to go back and spend the time to investigate this case? Or even, like, what does that mean?
What does that mean? Justice for Marsha. And justice for so many others. The visibility that we can do something about a case that's been cold, and then seeking justice, if not for the family, but for the community. Because this is part of our history.
It is part of our history. I completely believe that, and I'm also worried about the future.
Protesters march down a sidewalk with signs and flags. Another day, Victoria walks down an otherwise empty sidewalk with her cane. Now she steps along a railing bordering the edge of the Hudson River. Text appears. The Christopher Street Piers. Standing in front of a thick concrete post, Victoria consults the map of the area from her office. Wearing dark sunglasses, she looks up from the map and out over the water. Archival footage shows a helicopter soaring over the river, a dilapidated building on a pier jutting into the Hudson below. In the present, Victoria strolls along the immaculately modernized pier. She wipes a tear from her cheek. An old video looks down the decaying pier and surrounding structure, water visible through a gaping hole in the broken floor. Victoria gazes out over the river, old wood pilings sticking just out of the water. The view in the old video moves around the rundown structure, then looks out over the sparkling surface of the Hudson. In the present, Victoria has her back to the gently rippling river.
Whatever happened must have been around here.
She paces back and forth, her brow furrowed, then shifts to face the water. Her scarf and long skirt flutter in the wind as she stands by two observation binoculars on the pristine pier. Elsewhere, a rainbow flag flaps from the windows of a townhouse, displaying a star within the female symbol, the cross angled like the male symbol. Footage shows a dark-haired transgender woman smoking inside.
We live as who we are. This is us. This is us being at home.
Transy House, Brooklyn, New York.
I don't know. We just want to be ourselves. The woman we are inside out. Right? Am I wrong?
She's right.
It started out, it was just Chelsea and me.
Rusty May Moore.
And then people just started to come. We started to think of ourselves as, you know, this was the house that Sylvia and Marcia had. And we really looked at Star House as our reference point.
In the video, Sylvia puts her arm around Chelsea Goodwin in the house.
Oh, there they are. I have to get this picture.
1996.
She'd been homeless and she'd been living on a pier and that sort of thing. And I said, hey, you're not homeless. I got a place. As long as I got a place, you're not homeless. She didn't move in right away, but she started coming around, you know. She'd do some work in the backyard, do some work around the house in lieu of paying rent.
When they're out in the streets, we have to help one another. We really do. It's important.
The people in the house really related to Sylvia. She mothered them in a way, you know, and gave advice. She talked with them. But when she sobered up, then she was much better at that. Just like cold turkey, bang, no more drinking.
Sylvia speaks at an event.
We have to remember, we must continue to fight this government because this government is the one that's going to keep us divided at all times.
That's when she sort of got back into her role, I think, as an activist in the community. And all of a sudden we noticed people are coming up and saying, you're Sylvia Rivera, aren't you? Whoa, I thought you was dead. I began to realize that, you know, she really had a lot of projection in the community.
June 25th, 2000, Rome, Italy. Barricades hold back a huge crowd.
Une immense fête avec pour enjeu lutter contre les discriminations.
Dans les rues de Rome, la World Gay Pride a rassemblé 200 000 homosexuels, transsexuels et lesbiennes, italiens, mais aussi américains, français ou allemands.
Some people hold rainbow umbrellas below an identically hued balloon arch. The Gay Pride attendees fill the street. Among them, Sylvia holds a microphone.
It really gives me great pleasure to be here in representation of the gay liberation movement and the transgender movement all the way from the United States. I didn't think 31 years ago that I would have so many children, but I'm proud to have liberated you. Be that and well thrive and continue your struggle all around the world. The crowd went crazy. At one point in between my speech, they started calling me a living myth in Italian. Mystica, mystica.
Sylvia embraces people and poses for photos.
Oh my God, it's her. And people were coming up and kissing my hand and then giving me the double kiss and going through the whole scenario with a little bit of English that they knew. Oh, thank you for what you did at Stonewall. So I was really emotional about the whole thing. Guess
okay.
What?
What?
Guess where Mother has keys to nowadays?
At Transy House.
To the church. Mother
to the
got
church.
A job at the church.
What are you doing?
Bagging up food and whatnot.
And are they paying you?
Yes.
No kidding.
I can go home and say that I've actually tried to make a difference.
Oh, that's what marriage does to you.
She's made me an honest woman.
Well, really? That's true.
I mean, of all people, Sylvia Rivera had the keys to a church.
At night, people march down a street holding candles. One carries a painting of young Sylvia, and another holds up a poster with her photo. The text below it reads, Sylvia Rivera, 1951 to 2002. Sylvia's wife rides in a carriage clutching an urn.
Sylvia Rivera was 50 years old when she died of liver cancer last week.
Virtually up until the moment she died, she was lobbying for legislation to protect the rights of this most despised of minorities.
A reverend addresses a packed church.
Doubtless there will be many stories told about Sylvia. Some truth, some pure myth. That happens with great leaders. And make no mistake tonight, Sylvia Rivera is the mother of our movement. A great leader.
In the memorial march, people operate a giant Sylvia puppet. The Reverend carries a tall candle, while behind her a wreath is hoisted overhead. At the Christopher Street piers, mourners throw the wreath into the Hudson River. Outside the criminal courts building, Victoria stands with a man and a trans woman, Zena Grandicelli, volunteer at AVP.
I'm tired of people assaulting and murdering trans women. I want it changed, and it's gonna change. Because we're going to keep pushing the issue until it does. Nobody's prosecuting these people properly. They don't get what any other murderer would get. They get a pat on the wrist and a little bit of time and let go. This judge and DA have to do the right thing. Prosecute him like you would a regular person.
In the courtroom, the defendant and lawyers take their seats.
As everyone is aware, we're here today for sentencing. The people are going to be reading, I understand, a statement.
I'm going to be reading a statement that was sent to me by the biological father of Islam Nettles. He had asked me personally to read this on his behalf. There was a very outgoing, free-spirited, young, promising individual that had a very bright future, that had the potential to make a mark in the world, and it came to a screeching halt by an individual that was upset because he was clowned by his friends, because he didn't know that the woman he was trying to holler at was actually a transgender woman. He made a conscious decision to beat a transgender woman to death because of who she was and the embarrassment he felt he had suffered. I was extremely proud of the person she became, but no matter what amount of time this man gets will never fill the hole in my heart that a person that had such a magnificent future and was my only child and a lifelong gift had once filled.
Mr. Dixon, I hereby sentence you to a determinate sentence of imprisonment with a term of 12 years. All right, we're adjourned.
Outside the building.
This young man is only going to end up doing 10 and a half years, learn nothing, come back out and do this again. This needs to stop. We're not letting none of this go anymore.
In her office, Victoria holds a pen between her fidgeting fingers as she stares off with a distant expression. Now she unfolds a piece of paper and flips through pages of a thick file. Standing at her board filled with articles and photos, Victoria removes the index cards. Sitting at her desk, she goes through more of her files and notes. She addresses an envelope to an agent at the FBI New York office. Later, she carries the bulky envelope under her arm as she trudges down the sidewalk, then approaches the visitor entrance at the FBI office. She waits as one of the guards speaks into a walkie-talkie. Footage shows Marsha in a sparkling headdress.
Hey, everybody goes sooner or later. I love me tomorrow is not promised to anyone. I learned that in church when I was 5 years old. And I've never forgotten it. So, every day, you know, counts.
She grins. In the present, Victoria leaves the FBI office. She now wears a photo of Islam Nettles next to her Marsha pin. Later, Victoria sits on a bench, her eyes glassy and thoughtful. She leans forward, wiping tears from her face.
Come on, girl. Sit up.
Later, she strolls along a walkway overlooking the East River and the Manhattan skyline beyond. After gazing out over the water, she shifts her gaze forward and continues on. Cut to black. Credits appear, directed and produced by David France. Executive producer Joy A. Thompson. Written by David France, Mark Blaine. Produced by L.A. Teodosio, Kimberly Reed. Executive producers Alan Goetz, Sarah Ramirez, Martine Rothblatt, Stanley Tomchin. Executive producers Ben Kottner, Zaina Lawrence, Lisa Nishimura. Cinematographers Tom Bergman, Adam Ull. Editor Tyler H. Walk. Co-executive producers Mike C. Manning, Terrence Mack. Co-producers Christos Constantinopoulos, Ted Snowden and Duffy Violante, Tyler H. Walk. Original music by Bryce Dessner. Associate producers Mark Blaine, Dan Silver, Clelia Simpson, Jared Ruga, Andrew Tobias. Music supervisor Lynn Feinstein. Dana Deandra Turner Esquire for her tireless legal work on behalf of incarcerated transgender people. A photo of Dana appears below. Country of origin, United States of America. Sylvia and Marsha LLC is the author of this motion picture for the purposes of U.S. copyright law and the Berne Convention, as well as other international laws giving effect thereto. Ownership of this motion picture is protected under the laws of the United States of America and other countries. Any unauthorized duplication, distribution, or exhibition of this motion picture, or any part thereof, including soundtrack, could result in criminal prosecution as well as civil liability. The Death and Life of Marsha P. Johnson. MarshaPJohnsonMovie.com. Copyright 2017, Sylvia and Marsha, LLC. All rights reserved. Letters pop out from a white background, then turn red. Netflix.